This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley. Episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you can't wait, head over to BBC Sounds, where you can listen to the latest episodes a whole week earlier, first on BBC Sounds. If you'd like to stay up to date with the latest episodes, make sure you subscribe to Lady Killers on the BBC Sounds app and have push notifications switched on.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. This is where true crime meets history, with a twist. Today, I'm investigating a heartbreaking murder case from the Victorian age. This is a story which stirred passions, divided the nation, and inspired one of Britain's greatest novelists. I must warn you that you will hear graphic descriptions of violent injury and domestic violence from the start.
I had never struck him before after all his ill treatment, but he hit me so hard.
The absence of blood everywhere but in this room seems to show that he must have been killed in this room.
I am accused of murdering my husband, but I'm as innocent as the angels in heaven.
This is Lady Killers. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we revisit cases of women who killed from across the UK and USA. These are ordinary women who did extraordinary things. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask, how did they do it? And more importantly, what drove them to it? At 6 o'clock in the morning on the 6th of July, 1856, in the tiny village of Birdsmoorgate in Dorset in the southwest of England, a woman called Harriet Knight is called to come next door by her neighbour, Martha Brown. On the living room floor of the cottage, Martha's husband, John, is lying dead.
He was laying face down. There was blood on the floor, running out of his head. The air was full of brains. There was a dreadful wound on the left side of his head.
Martha tells her neighbour Harriet.
I heard him under the window about 2 this morning. I went down to the door and he said, the horse. And that was all. I brought him inside and placed him in a chair and he laid in my lap and took hold of my dress and held me so tight for 2 hours. I could not call anyone until he got so weak he let go.
The problem for Martha is that the only blood to be seen is in that room where John's body lies, which strongly suggests that he was killed there. If he had been kicked by a horse, there would have been a trail of blood from the field to the house. Martha sticks to her story for several weeks. In fact, she doesn't reveal the truth until after she's tried for and convicted of John's murder. It's only then that she finally reveals that John has abused her emotionally and physically for years. And it's from the condemned cell that she finally tells the truth about what really happened on that terrible night.
He came home at 2 a.m. in liquor and was sick. I asked him if he'd been at Mary Davis's. He then kicked out the bottom of the chair upon which I had been sitting. We continued quarrelling until 3 a.m. when he struck me a severe blow on the side of my head. At the same time, he reached down from the mantelpiece a heavy horsewhip and struck me across the shoulders with it 3 times. He then kicked me on the left side, which caused me much pain, and he immediately stooped down to untie his boots. Oh, I was so enraged and in an ungovernable passion. on being so abused and struck. I directly seized a hatchet which was lying close to where I sat, and I struck him several violent blows on the head. I cannot say how many. He fell at the first blow on his head, with his face towards the fireplace. He never spoke or moved afterwards.
I want to know, will Martha's revelation of what really happened that night, about the abuse she suffered, save her from the gallows? What can her story tell us about women experiencing domestic abuse in Victorian England and about women in similar circumstances today? To help me answer these questions, I'm so pleased to be joined by our guest detective, the solicitor Harriet Wistrich. Harriet is the founder of the Centre for Women's Justice and the co-founder of the campaigning organisation Justice for Women. She works tirelessly on behalf of women who've murdered their partners after years of abuse. And this is described in her fascinating book, Sister-in-Law, Fighting for Justice in a System Designed by Men. Harriet, the warmest of welcomes to Lady Killers.
Hi, Lucy. Lovely to be here.
Now, Harriet, a lot of people will know you as the solicitor who led Sally Challen's successful 2019 appeal when her conviction for murdering her abusive husband was overturned. Harriet, for those who aren't familiar, could you say a bit about the Sally Challen case?
Yes, Sally Challen killed her husband, Richard, after over 30 years of marriage, and she was convicted of his murder. And I took up her case subsequently, and we found grounds of appeal which related to the circumstances of coercive and controlling behaviour that characterised the relationship. And that, together with psychiatric evidence, led to her conviction being overturned in 2019.
As we will see, there are lots of distressing parallels between Martha Brown's story and Sally Challen's own. So I'm guessing that that description that Martha gives there at the moment that she snaps perhaps sounds familiar to you, does it?
Yes, I mean, it's actually a classic description, whether it's with a hammer in the case of Sally Challen or a hatchet in the case of Martha Brown. And I think one of the problems that plays out in Martha's case and in many of the cases that I've heard and looked at over the years where women have been accused of murdering violent partners is, in order to understand that, you really have to go back not just in the minutes and hours before the fatal blow, but in terms of the history of the relationship and, in fact, the whole history of the defendant, in order to really understand what was going on in her head at that particular moment.
That's why you're exactly the right person to be talking to about this particular case. Now, to find out more about Martha Brown, I went with our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to Shire Hall Museum in Dorchester. This is Dorchester's historic courtroom from the late 18th century. It's very dramatic. High galleries for the spectators, what I would call a throne for the judge. And then this terrific dock elevated up above the other people in the courtroom. And that's where Martha Brown was tried for the murder of her husband in 1856. She would have been brought up from the cells down below and she'd have come bursting out into this very bright, light, intimidating space with everybody's eyes upon her. What can you tell me about Martha Brown's life so far, Ross?
Well, she was born Elizabeth Martha Clark in Whitechurch in Dorset in 1811. At the age of 20, she got married to a man called Bernard Bairn. And they had two children, William and Thomas, but unfortunately the children died young and within a month of each other. After 10 years, her husband died. Martha met her second husband, John Brown, when they were working as servants together, and they got married in 1852. They moved to Bird's Moorgate, which is near Beminster, also in Dorset. Martha, she was a good-looking woman. She was in her 40s at the time of this case, and she kept a small grocer's shop. John, he was quite a bit younger than her, 18 years younger, and he was working as a carter. So there's quite an age difference. Now, unfortunately, they didn't have a good marriage, and we know this from Martha's confession. She said that she had suffered terrible ill treatment from him. We know that John would go out drinking and he'd come home late, drunk, and beat his wife quite severely. And Martha also believed that John was having an affair with a neighbour called Mary Davies.
Mm.
Yeah.
When Martha was in that dock just there, why couldn't she plead provocation? He'd beaten her, she was acting in self-defence. Why didn't she do that?
Now, we do see in the 19th century men who are charged with murdering their wives using provocation as an excuse to reduce their punishment, to reduce the charge to manslaughter. And they bring evidence of a wife not fulfilling her wifely duties, you know, of having an affair. We also see women in the 19th century who are convicted of murdering their husbands find sympathy with a jury who recommend them to mercy on account of the extreme provocations they have suffered, for example, violence at the hands of their husband. So Martha could have come clean. She could have admitted in the dock that she had killed him. She might have found sympathy. However, it was a huge risk to take because she would have had to prove that he had been violent to her in the past and also that she was a good wife, that she had done her side of the bargain.
And it's really hard to prove those things within the privacy of marriage and domestic life. I can see it was much safer for her to say there was no murder, it was the horse. Harriet Wistrich, listening to Roz talking about that defence of provocation, reminds me of something I've heard you quoted saying, which is, men kill in anger, women kill through fear. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's my experience of having looked at this issue over the past 30 years. So we know that many women who are convicted of murder in these circumstances are victims of domestic abuse, and they have killed usually because they have been driven to it out of fear, out of desperation, and out of reaching the end of their tether, not because they just are suddenly confronted with a situation that makes them so angry that they kill.
Now, you've spent many years arguing that the law is not gender neutral, which in turn makes it unfit for purpose for half of the population. Can you explain what you mean by that?
The law is constructed around a male response, a typical male response. If a woman is violent, that is seen as a really big transgression in a way that if a man is violent, that's a bit more normal and within the realm of what might be expected of a male response. So if a woman doesn't behave in the way that we expect a woman to behave, she tends to be judged more severely, in my experience.
Hmm. Thank you. Let's get back to the story and back to the courtroom and to Martha's trial for murder. The prosecution argues that Martha killed John because she's jealous of his relationship with Mary Davies. Witnesses, including his friend and fellow carter, Thomas Fuchs, give John some excellent character references.
He was a very quiet, inoffensive man, a very nice sort of man, and very good-tempered. I never saw him so far in liquor that he could not do his work. He and the prisoner behaved very well to each other.
No mention is made of John's violent mistreatment of Martha. Several witnesses give compelling evidence that John must have been killed in the cottage because there was no blood outside it. And the local surgeon further undermines Martha's story.
The wounds were not such as could be caused by the kicking of a horse. I had the shoes taken off John Brown's horse, and I came to the conclusion that those shoes could not have inflicted them. They were such as might have been produced by a blunt instrument, such as a hatchet.
All Martha's defence lawyer can do is to argue that she wouldn't have killed her husband because she depended on his income. And he plays up to the stereotype that a female like Martha simply wouldn't use this sort of force.
Would such violence have been committed by a woman? It was frightful to her nature. A brutal man might have done it.
Harriet Wistrich, I'm struck by how Martha and John are characterised in court. She's a woman driven to murder by jealousy. He's a good man who's kind to his wife. I'm guessing that this situation where a man can be abusive to his wife at home, but also present a totally different friendly face to the outside world, is something that's familiar to you from cases that you've worked on?
Extremely familiar. And that can be highly problematic if the woman hasn't been able to articulate it to anyone out of shame or because they won't be believed or whatever. And so we do have cases where perhaps no one really saw the extent of the violence and the extent to which that woman becomes entrapped in the relationship.
Let's see what happens next. The jury considers its verdict for 4 hours. Eventually, though, they reach a decision: guilty. And the judge passes the inevitable sentence of death.
I entirely concur with the verdict of the jury. You have been found guilty of willful murder, a crime, in your case, greatly aggravated by the fact that the person you have murdered was your own husband. He was not only a fellow creature, but the being you had solemnly promised to love, to honor, and obey. This greatly aggravates your guilt.
Harriet, what do we think about that then? The judge says the murder isn't the half of it. You've also failed to obey your husband. Presumably that's gone now in society.
I think it has moved on, but it does exist for certain women, particularly women I've worked with or cases I've followed of women from South Asian backgrounds, very strict Muslim background, where there is this very, very strong sense that you must honour and obey your husband, and to transgress from that is a huge crime in itself.
Have I got this right, Harriet, that women are more likely than men to use a weapon to defend themselves against an abusive partner, but that using a weapon gets you a longer sentence?
Yes, that's absolutely right. This is another example of actually how the law is sexist. The use of a weapon is seen as an aggravating factor which will add years onto your sentence.
So as a murderer, you get a longer sentence for using a weapon. And as women are physically weaker, they're more likely to use weapons. Therefore, they're getting longer sentences for murder.
Exactly.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Back to Martha's story and to a dramatic turn of events. On the 7th of August, 2 days before her scheduled execution, Martha's actually in the condemned cell when she finally makes her confession to the prison governor. She tells the truth about what happened on that awful night when John came home drunk at 2 o'clock in the morning.
We continued quarrelling until 3 a.m. when he struck me a severe blow on the side of my head, which confused me so much that I was obliged to sit down. At the same time, he reached down from the mantelpiece a heavy horsewhip with a plain end and struck me across the shoulders with it 3 times. He then kicked me on the left side, which caused me much pain. And he immediately stooped down to untie his boots. Oh, I was such enraged and in an ungovernable passion on being so abused and struck.
This is the moment Martha picks up the hatchet and hits John several times on the head. It's ironic, as she's been using that hatchet to break up coals for the fire to keep John's supper warm for him. She ends her confession with these words.
As soon as I had done it, I would have given the world not to have done it. I had never struck him before after all his ill treatment, but when he hit me so hard, this time I was almost out of my senses and hardly knew what I was doing.
Harriet, I'm feeling a strange blend of emotions here because it's horrible to hear such a gruesome description of violence, isn't it? But it's also curiously a relief to hear Martha telling what I believe to be the truth.
Exactly, yes. And I think she expresses that very, very powerfully. And it is this moment that it becomes too much, that you lose it and then something breaks And then afterwards, that terrible regret or remorse that is often felt by women who've killed their partner or husband.
Yeah, because you've taken a life, that's bad, and you've taken the life of somebody you presumably once loved as well.
Exactly.
Or still loved.
Yes. I mean, Sally Challen used to tell me when I talked to her in prison several years later, I miss him so much. He was the love of my life. I mean, I think she gradually moved on from that by recognising the level of abuse and control that he inflicted on her. But there was such a deep sense of attachment.
Harriet, why do you think that Martha finally confesses?
I suspect she just needed to say the truth. You know, she may have felt that her best chance of not being convicted of murder was to tell a lie, but that didn't work. And now she wants people to understand what happened and to understand why she did what she did.
I went back to Dorchester with Ros Crone to find out what happened after Martha made her confession.
We are in rather a desolate, windy courtyard in front of Dorchester Prison, in front of the most gigantic, looming, intimidating gateway. I think the prison closed in 2014, is that right, Ros?
Yes, that's right. And at the time of our case in the 1850s, it would have held between 100 and 140 prisoners at any one time, mostly men, of course.
Once Martha Brown was inside this prison, I think I'm right in saying there was a big sort of build-up of public support for her. Is that so?
Yes, there was sympathy for Martha even before she made her confession. And towns got together and sent petitions in begging for her reprieve, for mercy.
I understand that it was behind these doors, in her cell, in the condemned cell, that Martha finally made her famous confession, saying that her husband had been violent and abusive towards her. What happened after that?
Yes, well, as soon as Martha makes her confession, the prison chaplain and the local MP dash down, get the train to London in the hope of seeing the Home Secretary and getting a reprieve. Now, time is really tight. This was on the 8th of August, the day before her scheduled execution. When they make it to London, they find that the Home Secretary isn't there. He's in Ireland, and so their trip really is in vain.
Is there no one else who can grant a reprieve?
Only the Home Secretary can grant a reprieve. And so at 5 o'clock, they send a telegraph back to Dorchester saying, we're sorry, but the execution must go ahead as scheduled.
That's terrible. That's such a heartbreaking piece of bad luck. If he had been in London, he might well have reprieved her.
He might. We don't know for certain, but I think there would have been a good chance. So Martha then is hanged on the 9th of August, 1856, outside Dorchester Prison, actually on top of this gatehouse up here.
Wow.
They get everything ready, but then unfortunately the executioner realises that he hasn't tied a band around her skirt to preserve her modesty when he lets the drop go. So he has to dash up back the scaffold again and fix that, causing quite a bit of extra stress. But she is hanged, and it is widely reported in the newspapers. But interestingly, some newspapers, in their reporting on the execution, they don't even mention the violence that Martha had suffered at the hands of John. And a big crowd gathers to watch this execution too, around 3,000 to 4,000 people in this space here that we're standing in, watching up there. And among that crowd was the future famous novelist Thomas Hardy. He was only 16 at the time, and he remembered this execution. He remembered the story of Martha, and it became the inspiration for his novel Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
It's astonishing to think that the real Martha Brown being hanged up there would inspire the fictional Tess of the D'Urbervilles. A very, very powerful character who likewise gets hanged for what she did in response to the abuse of a man.
That's right.
Ros has now joined us in the studio. Hi there, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Harriet.
Ros, there was a massive public outcry about the hanging of Martha Brown. Did this outcry have any long-term consequences?
Yes, you're right. Several newspapers were full of letters to the editor in which they debated, you know, whether or not Martha should have been hanged at all. But long term, no, it didn't lead to any substantial change in the law. Execution was finally moved behind the prison walls in 1868. But even then, it survived nearly 100 years longer until 1964, when it was finally abolished.
Of course, yes. And Harriet, you and your fellow lawyers, fellow campaigners, you've made enormous strides in how the law treats domestic homicide and the victims of domestic abuse. But what is there more left to be done?
There's a lot more to be done, because although over the years we have worked very hard to try and improve the position, we still see many women being convicted of murder despite killing in circumstances where they're victims of abuse. And we did have a whole Law Commission consultation around this issue only 20 years ago, which recommended changes to the law. It resulted in the abolition of the defence of provocation and its replacement by loss of control, recognising that women might kill out of fear of violence. But research and what we've seen shows that this hasn't actually made any difference, that actually women aren't successfully using that, and that's also borne out by our experience.
So, Harriet, nearly 200 years later, if someone in Martha Brown's situation today put forward a defence of loss of control, you think the outcome would still be uncertain?
The reality is that, yes, she should succeed with loss of control. In fact, it's a classic case of loss of control, and she might succeed, but there's no guarantee of it.
Yes.
The jury might not buy it, and she might nonetheless be convicted of murder. If the case had been played out well, it's possible a jury would have returned a verdict of manslaughter rather than murder in the facts of her case. But I've seen other cases where they haven't.
Mm. Well, what do you take away from the sad story of Martha Brown?
Well, historians of violence have argued that from the medieval period all the way through to the modern period, there has been a decline of violence in society. And the 19th century occupies an important place in that story. While violence in public spaces, on the streets, did decline, the same cannot be said for violence within the home. And some historians have even argued that societal pressures and evolving gender expectations, in fact, led to an increase in domestic violence. When women fought back, or if they snapped, like Martha did, they could be met with sympathy from judges, from juries, but only if they could prove that they had fulfilled their role as a dutiful wife. Juries, criminal justice, and the law operate within a social context. And so we can change the law, but we also need to change societal attitudes, expectations, and perceptions about gender, about relationships, etc.
And Harriet, what do you take away from the story of Martha Brown?
I think the big difference in context, the really big difference, is we don't have capital punishment. So even though you have these cases where there's a potential to build an appeal and to overturn the murder conviction, it's too late. Once somebody's dead, they're dead and that's it. And I do think Martha's case, there would have been definitely grounds to explore an appeal against her murder conviction. And that just wasn't possible.
Well, I wish Martha had had you on her side.
Thank you. I wish I could have been there. Mm.
This is such a sad story. Before we started talking about this case, I really didn't understand why Martha Brown told that lie about the horse. But now I think I do. And women like Harriet Wistrich are still having to challenge the sexism in the criminal justice system to this day. But as that vital work continues, let's remember Martha Brown and all the women today who continue to be punished simply for choosing to survive. Well, huge thanks to Harriet Wistrich, Professor Rosalind Crone, and the Shire Hall Museum, Dorchester. Next time, the story of Chloe, an enslaved black teenager who drowns two children. Is she an unrepentant killer, or is this a way of taking justice for herself? Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley for BBC Radio 4 is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett, William Hope, Jonathan Keeble, and Ruth Sillers. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhianne Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen first to the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. See you next time.
Hello, Alex von Tunzelman here with a brand new series of History's Heroes. People with purpose, brave ideas, and the courage to stand alone. Including the little-known story of a famous author caught up in a horrific accident, which would require all his courage.
Dickens remained in the river, helping the rescue, assisting the wounded. He didn't search out to be heroic. He didn't play on his heroism.
Subscribe to History's Heroes on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.